Hey everyone, super excited about today's guest on the podcast. It is the one and only founder and president of Deschutes Brewery, Gary Fish. This guy started the craft beer scene in Bend back in 1986, and he's built the empire we all know of as Deschutes Brewery with epic beers like Black Butte Porter and Fresh Squeeze IPA. The list goes on and on and on. Actually, their brewery is just on the other side of our studio right here. So I was just like, why don't we have Gary on? And boy, do we get into some really, really awesome educational stuff when it comes to how to build a business from the ground up, going into how he was looking to just have a successful pub. And guess what? It wasn't successful, but the beer was. So he pivoted and boom, now we have Deschutes. Get into a lot of stuff on how he ticks. I hope you're able to pick up some of this stuff and apply it in your own business leader enterprises. And this podcast is brought to you by Mazama Media. Click the link below to get our 3 insider tips on how to make your Facebook ads convert for free. We may have been in video form as well, so it's super easy to pick up and implement. Hope you enjoy them. And without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with me and Gary Fish with Deschutes Brewery. Gary, I'd like to start. The one thing that a lot of people see Deschutes as is kind of like Ben's original big business. And you might even not think yourself a big business, but relative to Ben, you know, you are. And so you started that. And I guess, what do you think about that? First, you started laughing. So what do you think about that, Ben's original big business?
Well, I still don't think of it as a big business. Mm-hmm. I recognize that we have, you know, established ourselves, particularly amongst now what is a considerable number of small breweries. But, you know, I came to town when there was still an operating sawmill mm-hmm. here.
The old mill?
Yeah.
You mean that used to not be a movie theater in Chaps?
Yeah, and there was and this side of the river was another sawmill. Hmm. So
where Deschutes is now.
Where you guys are now,
more
appropriately. Actually, okay. this area was stacks of lumber. It was closer to where the pavilion is, mm-hmm. The ice rink, and that area from there to the river. There was another bridge that crossed the river that was a railroad bridge at that time. Most of that was pretty much gone by the time we got here. But No. This came down, I think, early 80s, late 70s, something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, we've got a pretty large hospital mm-hmm. and large medical community. I think there's a lot of businesses that have grown here.
But when you started 87?
88.
Okay, so a year after I was born. When did you first
that
have...
That doesn't make me feel old at all.
Hey, I'm only 32. But when did you first get a realization of like... Or was it like that from the very beginning? I have no idea. When was it for you, Gary, like this is starting to gain some steam?
Well, there were a number of moments like that along the journey.
What was the first one?
You know, the first one was really when we were brewing downtown, and that was all we had was the little pub downtown. And
is it the same location?
The same location. It wasn't particularly successful, mm-hmm. But the beer was good, and tavern owners in Portland came to us wanting to buy the beer, and a distributor from Portland said, "Hey, you know, if you can send me some kegs, we'll, you know, these guys want to buy your beer, and we can sell some for you."
At the time, was that Mirror Pond, Al?
It wasn't Mirror Pond at first.
Okay.
We had 3 beers to begin with. Cascade Golden Ale, Bachelor Bitter, and Black Butte Porter. Mm-hmm. And we started selling Bachelor Bitter and Black Butte Porter first. And it came down, you know, we needed money. We weren't being particularly successful as a pub. Mm-hmm. And so we began sending kegs to Portland, and that part of the business started to grow. We were adding on to the building. We were adding new tanks. I paid off the bank for about 15 minutes. And, you know, we were operating Our warehouse was across the street behind the pub building now called the Cigar Building, which I think should be called the Brewery Building because we were there first. But any rate, and we were running a forklift between the two and finally got a letter from the city saying we were operating an industrial operation in the downtown commercial business district, and we weren't allowed to do that.
Going back and forth with
loading trucks in the middle of the street.
That's
amazing. It was cool. We were kind of living the dream at that point in time. But when they said
right now,
we couldn't do it.
Yeah, okay. But you were doing, so you weren't asking.
No.
To do. You're just like, this is what we need to do.
We were doing it without really thinking about it.
I think that's a big take home because people oftentimes they'll ask, and then the city will be like,
well,
there is
kind of that rule, you know, better to beg forgiveness than ask permission.
Oh, I live by that.
Yeah. So, we weren't intentionally trying to do anything wrong, but we were running a business, growing a business. You know, like I said, we were kind of, you know, living the dream there for a little bit. But when the city kind of notified us that this wasn't what you're supposed to be doing in that zone, we realized that we couldn't shrink back to what we used to be. We needed to continue to grow. And then we began to look. And that was the first moment where it was like, oh, this is getting a little bit bigger than I thought. And, you know, we bought the first piece of property over on this side of the river and began to build what was our larger production facility. Something I knew very, very little about. There were very few people around that had the expertise to understand how to design and build it. We used the same gentleman we used to design our original pub brewing system to design the first system here, a man named Frank Appleton, who lives up in British Columbia and you know, was a British brewer, brewed, you know, in Canada for 25 years. And we began, you know, to kind of drink from the fire hose.
So going back to when you first start getting the business going and the pub is not being successful, how many people did it start with when you opened the pub?
Well, it's a funny story. I was a restaurant guy, and I had opened like 7 restaurants or been involved in the opening of 7 restaurants. So I thought I knew a fair amount about it. I had just helped a friend open a brew pub in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I thought I was prepared for what was to come. And we moved to Bend. We had a building. Everything went great with the city. I mean, and you know, we visited Bend in September of 87, came back, brought my wife here for our anniversary, which is October 5th. We moved here by Thanksgiving, and the pub opened the following June. Okay. So, you know, try doing that in this town today.
Yeah, no.
So, you know, things are running. I'm the only guy working, and I've got all the employee manuals and menus and recipes, and everything is ready to go. And comes time to hire staff, and I've arranged for all the construction workers to work in the back of the building. I rented a couple of 8-foot tables, you know, boxes of pencils, stacks of applications, you know, pots of coffee. I'm ready to go. Mm-hmm. Sunday, the ad runs in the bulletin. Monday morning, you know, it's applications start at 8 a.m. I'm there at 7, ready to go. 8 o'clock comes. 9 o'clock comes.
Nobody's
10 o'clock
there.
Comes. Nobody showed up.
You needed some social media back then.
So by the, we had, you know, town crier. That was kind of the social media back then. But No, by the end of the week, I had had a grand total of 15 applicants.
How many people did you need to hire?
Of which I was forced to hire 12.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Why was nobody? Did you ever figure out why?
Well, I think what I figured, and somewhat perhaps cynically, was that the people who applied with me had already worked everywhere else in town.
Mm.
I mean, it was not an all-star crew by any stretch of the imagination. And so we had, you know, I had hired a guy, convinced me to hire him as our kitchen manager. He lasted 2 weeks.
Great.
You know, so then I'm doing that too, and in addition to everything else.
You're spinning a lot of plates.
But, you know, but the beer was good, and people kept coming out.
So why was the beer good?
Well, because I was very lucky to have hired a very talented brewer, a man by the name of John Harris.
Okay.
People who've been in town and been around the pub for a long time remember John. He went on to brew for about 20 years for Full Sail in Portland, and he now owns his own brewery called Ecliptic Brewing Company in North Portland.
So did you foresee this business, all like this mini or big empire, depending on the perspective of who you're talking to, my perspective big, being built from a pub that you were trying to make successful at the time?
Never.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
Never. No, it wasn't until... We've been in business 31 years. We probably started really thinking proactively about our future maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first 10 years, I mean, we really didn't sell much. People just came and bought it. All we had to do was figure out how to continue to produce it and maintain the quality. But it started to become a big business. We started to add systems. I mean, I've always considered myself a really good restaurant manager and not qualified for everything else that I was doing.
Yeah.
And I was trying to hire, quote, experts, but frequently not doing that very well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our level of mistakes, you know, got to be pretty great.
But what was the benefit that came from those mistakes?
Well, the benefit was craft beer was growing pretty rapidly. We were able to move through those mistakes based largely on the fact that the beer was always good.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the beer was good, we were able to you know, work through everything else we had to and then learn as we went.
Have you ever talked to an entrepreneur who you saw was in the same shoes that you were in back when you thought you, my perspective on this story is that you probably saw a bunch of Deschutes, like I'll have a Deschutes in, pub in Redmond, and then one day Portland, and then one day Boise, and I'll have all these pubs and it will be great, like franchise it. But instead it turned into, actually I'll be distributed across the country. And this is a completely different model, and it's not a restaurant model, and I'll have like two pubs.
Well, I never really anticipated having a chain of restaurants.
Okay.
And I've been in the restaurant business since I was 16. But, you know, a chain of restaurants is a difficult thing to manage and keep track of from my perspective. And that wasn't, you know, too many employees, you know, margins are razor thin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough business.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful business on a whole bunch of different levels, but you know, it becomes kind of more mercenary when you start taking on a lot more complexity by way of additional outlets. Whether it's franchise, you know, which only means that somebody else is representing your brand,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that's a challenge as well.
So what type of, when you started the restaurant business, did you believe in culture? Do you believe in a good culture as a keystone to a business today?
If so, well, if you're talking about the business culture, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the craft beer business is a lifestyle business.
Yeah.
It's a culture heavy business. And we've always tried to maintain, you know, a healthy, good culture. We've learned a lot about what that means over time, however. And, you know, when people talk about culture, it tends to be a lot more about, I call it the soft side of culture, you know, the benefits. You know, how many parties do you have? Do I get to bring my dog to work? You know, What kind of health benefits do you have? It's never about how highly can I perform the functions of my job. And that's where I think culture kind of goes off the rails. Whereas we all like to be friends with the people that we work with. We all like to be able to wear the clothes we want to wear to work, to be comfortable, whatever the reason is. We all like to have good social interactions. How often do we think about we need a culture of high performance to be able to allow us to have all those other things?
And so how do you implement a high performance culture?
Well, we're still learning, but you know, you have to have people that want to perform in that way. And you have to, like other aspects of culture, you've got to reinforce it as a management team to make sure that everyone, number one, understands what it is. Number two, why it's there, why it matters. And number three, you know, how it feeds all the other things that we enjoy working in a lifestyle industry.
What are some of the best things you've learned when it comes to implementing it, some of the best pros you've seen? Like, if it wasn't the fact that we didn't have a performance culture that we're trying to move, we wouldn't have X.
Well, I'm not completely sure I understand the question, but you know, the performance culture creates the profit center. Mm-hmm. I mean, businesses exist for profit.
I'm sorry, but that's true.
You know, it is.
I'm sorry,
true.
Everyone. Yeah,
and. You know, we don't want to acknowledge that, and
well,
oftentimes
because corporations have now become the enemy for some reason.
Well, with you know, kind of high touch culture, mm-hmm. that we really don't want to acknowledge that we need profit to drive that culture. Mm-hmm. And the more profit we have, the more latitude we have on how we drive the culture. So, if we're not making money, you know, nothing else is happening. The parties aren't nearly as much fun.
Yeah.
You know, all the benefits that create distraction are going to go away, mm-hmm. because you can't perform as well with that distraction. And when we're not making money, your performance matters a lot more than otherwise.
Has that been hard to watch those up and downs, like having the culture go up and having those parties and then the times when the company goes down and then back up? Or
yeah, we had a layoff in December.
Right.
That sucked.
How many people did you have to lay off?
Probably 35, and then we eliminated several positions that we were looking to fill before that as well. So, you know, those things are really hard on culture, but it's
probably,
all born of the fact that...
How are they on you?
Oh, horrible. Yeah. Horrible. The people that are involved in delivering the message, I mean, it's, you know, they, we did it in early December, and we got criticized because, you know, how could you do that before December? My response was, well, once you know that it's coming, once you know this is going to happen, it's better for everybody, yourself and everybody else, to let them know. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the sooner the better. You know, you don't want to sleep on that for too many nights.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly, you don't.
No, yeah, whenever I need to let go of someone, it's a horrible thing. It means that I failed on the hiring. It means I failed on teaching or whatever. But the longer I wait and I put it off, the more stress and anxiety I give myself.
Anytime anybody has to fire somebody, it's a failure of management.
Right.
You know, so the person didn't do a good job. Well, then you screwed up hiring. Mm-hmm. You know, you screwed up training. You screwed up in follow-up.
Yeah.
You know,
it always falls on me. And right. The problem that I'll run into is I still do this. I'm getting better at it, but I still do it. I still procrastinate it.
Oh, yeah. My dad has a saying. He loves to tell me we always hire too soon and fire too late.
Right. But the saying is supposed to be the opposite, right?
Yeah. You'd think, properly.
Hire slow, fire fast. That's yeah. what everybody's supposed to do. But I feel like we just go around saying that. But truthfully, I mean, mm-hmm. I've fired way too fast before, and I've fired way, way, way too slow. It's just, it's that human constitution within me that I think holds it back. You feel like you're doing good.
You
want to
be able to save. You know, it's an uncomfortable thing. And the human response is to, you know, ignore it or, you know, procrastinate at the very least. But the reality is, you know, that's, you want to be a leader. This is, you know, you don't want to have to fire anybody. Well, you better do a much better job at those three things, you know, hiring, training, or follow up.
And it's going to happen. It's going to continue. Like, well, there's going to be
odds,
people.
Odds tell you that.
Yeah. I mean, if you continue to hire, and especially at the scale that you do, I mean, there's going to be mistakes in the process. There's going to be people that say that they have all this stuff and it turns out that it didn't match up exactly how you wanted it to. And then when it comes time to make that decision where, okay, we tried, but we really have to push this off, when you can rip off that band-aid, the times that I have, you have, for me, 24 hours of stress before and then about 12 hours of stress after, anxiety, whatever you want to call it, and then it's pretty much done. And then the person is able to move on and grow because mm-hmm. they're just holding them and the team back, and now mm-hmm. you and the company are able to go on and grow. But again, that's easier said than done because I struggle with it still.
Yeah, I think if you don't struggle with it, you're
not human.
You're doing something wrong. Yeah. I mean, there have been times in my career when people thought I wore a black hood around, you know, around work. So
why is that?
No, just because it seemed like I was always the person in that position. This is my past life in the restaurant business.
But you it always seemed, person that was
seemed like I was always the person in the position that, you know, this person's got to go and I'm the one standing there. It's like, all right, you got to go. But I think it's one of those things that you have to take on and understand the responsibility of it. But if you don't like doing it, then you just have to be better at those other things.
So how has that helped? I mean, you have to make that hard decision. You made it in December, 35 people. Where's been the benefit? How has it helped the shoots now?
Well, the people that remain behind, quite frankly, are more focused. They're more motivated. It's like the path forward is clearer. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make it any easier necessarily, but it is, you know, presumably the people who are left behind are now all our high performers. Mm-hmm. Whether they were before or not, out of necessity, I mean, they are now. And quite frankly, you know, I've been proud as can be at how they've responded. And it's been, you know, I mean, it's still, we're not out of the woods yet, mm-hmm. but it's really terrific to see people, you know, step up and kind of take the bull by the horns.
Well, it seems that you guys are making some changes, and so you came and you're like, hey bud, so here's some stuff. And so just the first thing I ended up noticing was some different sort of artistic designs. This botanical oil is great. It's like gin and tonic, as you were saying. But here's this new thing, which is the iconic Black Butte Porter without Black Butte on it. It's a cool, looks to be a mountain lion eye with an eagle on it, and then some, that's its pupil. So it's looking at, looks like an eagle, but basically that's a huge change. You're going to get backlash from that. So how do you go through something like that?
Well, you know, what we're trying to do, number one, the largest changes to this are really the area above the six-pack box, the six-pack carrier.
Okay.
Where, you know, we used to have a black neck band, a black crown, and you've really got a dark brown neck. So if you look at it sitting on a store shelf, this top area disappeared back in the shadow mm-hmm. of the store shelf. We brought that out, made, you know, so we weren't using a lot of the space we were being allotted. The other thing is Deschutes. Number one, people can't pronounce it. That's why we've had to spell it phonetically.
Oh, is that Deschutes. Why you did that?
And,
oh, that's smart, because you have the Virginia
Deschutes or Deutsches. No, they can't pronounce it in Central Oregon. Make no mistake.
Oh, really?
Sad commentary.
Nobody can pronounce Mazama either.
Sad commentary on the American educational system, but true. So, and we figured we didn't have to put Deschutes Brewery on the package because people could figure out it was probably a from a brewery since it was, you know, beer. And that allowed us this big red block across the front. So, and then, you know, artists like to draw things, and they all these these labels have different representations where kind of the more you look, the more you see. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of mysterious little people and objects and things in there that you may or may not recognize. And the other mainline brands have similar type illustrations on there, that there's, you know, Bigfoot in there. And I mean, it's all Oregon stuff, but it's something to, for the person that, that wants to gaze into their beer label, you know, there's a lot of things to see there.
Yeah, I now end up seeing it. So I thought that was Black Butte within the Cougar's Eye, and it for sure is. So we have Black Butte, and then you have the Metolius coming off of it, and the tower, the fire tower up there, a cool eagle. Yeah. So now that comes right from there, and that's, I'm totally digging that. So you still do have the Black Butte and the Black Butte Porter. How's that decision get made? Do you just have a bunch? Do you have like four or five different artists come to you with like, this is a new
this,
Black Butte thing?
This work was done by an agency. Okay. We're trying to move more of that in house, but you know, little by little. And we talked to them about what we want. We had, I mean, this is 2 years in the making. Mm-hmm. We haven't changed packaging this extensively much in our history. But it is, you know, you talk about what you want. What do you want the consumer to focus on? You know, when you come in the grocery store and there are, you know, you've got a row of six packs on the store shelf. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you want the consumer to focus on? For us, the first thing was Deschutes. We don't want them to search for our beer in that massive, incredibly eye-glazing beer set in a typical grocery store.
Smart to make it in red, too.
So it's bright red. It pops. The neck label and the crowns help convey that as well. Then the second thing we want their eye to catch on is the style. So for this, it's Porter. You know, Deschutes, Porter, then Black Butte is kind of the order that if you just quickly glance at it, your eye should catch those three things in that order. This one is Deschutes Botanic Ale, and then because this is a special seasonal Bond Street series, we call it low volume seasonal, that you only have two things to go to. But for Mirror Pond Pale Ale, Deschutes, Pale Ale, Mirror Pond is typically where your eye should go. And I had a long discussion with the graphics people about that and impressed on them that I don't really care what your art does as long as the consumer sees these things in that order. And we think they did a brilliant job and really have captured that, plus kind of the fun, the whimsy, the mystery, the story of Central Oregon, et cetera. There are a lot of Black Buttes and Mirror Ponds in this world, but Central Oregon has some unique ones.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So, yeah, I'm digging it. Wondering, so in the past 2 years, are you guys responding and what are you all of a sudden major shift in design? Why? When was that meeting? So I guess it was 2 years ago. Why was that meeting? Happen? Why did that mean?
Well,
happen?
Because, you know, as volume started to slow down and people became familiar, you know, you try and look, what are the things that we can affect? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the beer, okay, we can't make major changes to the beer. Anything above a minor tweak is going to be identifiable. And there's too much risk. And we know that people typically really enjoy the beer. We've done enough market research to know that. There were some things fundamentally that were flawed about the last iteration of our packaging. Things like, you know, brands going around, you know, with the old oval around the corner, and people's eyes don't really follow around a sharp corner like that. So we wanted to straighten that out, get the labels to pop a little bit more, get them to work together in a billboard fashion on the shelves a little bit more.
That's cool.
And again, make it easier for people searching for the beer to find it.
Okay. How do you guys go about this huge new problem that you have just here locally being 10 barrel? So, I mean, you guys have had Bend under locks in Central Oregon because you are the original, and all of a sudden 10 barrel gets bought by Anheuser-Busch.
The largest brewing concern in the known universe.
Exactly. And at first, you have this huge social media backlash on them and just around town backlash. I can't believe they sold that, blah, 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 which that's a whole other conversation.
Go figure.
That's
why it didn't last long.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Go figure. Didn't last long. Not only that, but I mean, you build a business up, you should be allowed to sell it. I mean, come on. Why are you really?
I agree.
Yeah.
Bulletin called me the next day and said, you know, what do you think? Which I answered, about what? Well, about 10 barrel. So, well, what about 10 barrel? Well, they sold. So, yeah, I heard. Well, what do you think about that?
Good for them.
Nothing. Good for them. Well, what would you say if you saw those guys on the street? And I know them all real well.
High five.
And I said, I tell them congratulations.
Yeah.
I mean, it's clearly what they wanted. Those things don't happen overnight. It takes a long, long time to work those deals through, and if it's what they wanted, they executed it well. Good for them. Yeah. Why would it be anything else?
Mm-hmm.
People like to make, I guess people don't feel it enough in control of their lives these days, and the only way they can exercise control is criticizing somebody else on the internet. But
well, they can easily do it behind a screen because there's no repercussions for what they feel.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, so there you had that social media onslaught, and now you have that basically Scrooge Duck money, all the money they need to market and take over not only the town but the state and beyond. How do you deal with that?
Well, we've got to be really good at what we're good at, and I tell people all the time. So there's only one person in this world I control, and that's me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't control them. I don't control their rich uncle. I don't,
it's very stoic of you.
I don't, what am I going to do? This isn't Ford versus GM.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, I have enough on my plate just trying to make us the best Deschutes brewery that we can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they're going to do what that's why those companies want to acquire craft breweries.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can inject a little bit of money, fair amount of expertise, and they can control a part of their universe better than they are now.
Sure.
So I think that, if we can execute on our business plan well, I think we're going to be fine. There's room in the marketplace. I'm not really worried about them. The amount of market share we need to capture to be successful is small.
Mm-hmm.
So, we want to continue to engage our consumers. We want to make really good, really well-executed, exciting beers. And if we can do that, I think, we're going to continue to do just fine.
How many breweries were there in town when you started Deschutes?
You mean zero?
Yeah, there you go. That's the answer. So were you guys the first then?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you feel now that there's 28? Hey, Mitch, can I get
that? I don't know. It depends on inside the city limits or...
Isn't that what it is? Yeah, 28 is one, or 27, something like
25,
that.
25, 26, a couple went out, a few more came in. Yeah.
You know that's because of you, right?
Yeah, it's all because of me. I did it all.
No, it's the motivation. It's the inspiration.
Well, I mean,
if Deschutes can do it out of Bend, Oregon,
Bend is a lifestyle community.
Sure.
And craft beer is a lifestyle occupation. The combination of those two things is pretty natural. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I work, whether it was with the Oregon Brewers Guild, the Brewers Association of America, or now the Brewers Association, I worked long and hard to create the opportunity that those people are taking advantage of.
Really?
Well, sure. We created three trade associations to make getting in the beer business, getting into craft beer, easier.
Why would you do that? Why would you make more competition for yourself?
Well, at the time, we were sub 1% market share. Mm. We were just educating the consumer, educating legislators, educating bankers, educating regulators, and all the time. I mean, we weren't doing it specifically so that next year we'll have 10,000 breweries.
Yeah.
That wasn't the point. And quite frankly, I'm wondering, what in the world did we create? But but there were, a handful of us that worked pretty tirelessly to create the environment that allows these people, with their homebrew kit at home, to become a professional brewer in their garage, essentially. And does it create problems for us? Yeah, probably. Was it worth it? No question. What does it mean for the future? I have no idea. Work is going to be a lot tougher than I thought it was going to be at this stage of my career. But that's all right.
Yeah. Well, when I look at just in this conversation, the way that you look at problems and analyze business, you're very methodical and very business first oriented. So I'm curious, what is your number one business hack that you can say over the years?
I got that question earlier, and then I had to look up what hack meant, and it was between something you hit with an axe or kick with your foot. But
you want me to get
so I
shortcut.
So I asked, so to speak, I asked my assistant, and she's closer to millennial age. I could have called my kids. One of the things I like to lean back on, and that's really simple, and it's just do the right thing first.
Ah.
You know,
that's beautiful.
If you try to overthink things, you're going to screw it up. Mm-hmm. How do you know what the right thing is? Oh,
you just know.
You know.
I hate when people, and you're justifying doing the wrong thing once you say that.
No. It's far easier than you think.
Do you study Stoicism?
Do I what?
A philosophy called Stoicism? You ever look into it? Because you've been saying a lot of Stoic things so far.
Well, we actually had a beer called the Stoic, and we did some research into that at the time, but it's not a studied response. It's just born of probably a lot of tough experience.
Yeah. There's an understanding of doing the right thing is mostly what the philosophy talks about. It's just like, you know, to do the right thing. And if you have to think about it, then it's probably the wrong thing.
If it turns out not to be exactly right, it's going to be pretty close anyway.
Yeah.
So, it's the effort counts for a lot.
The difficult part with that, with entrepreneurs that are trying to get going or people who already have their businesses going and they haven't been doing the right thing, but they tell themselves that it is, though, because in the end I was able to get the deal and I was able to get more people hired because I did that thing that I knew was not ethically right.
Life is not perfect.
I'm not saying that they're right. I'm just saying
Ethics, generally speaking, if you cheat your way into a good deal, mm-hmm. it's still cheating.
Sure.
If later you turn around and donate money to, Boys and Girls Club, still cheating.
Yep.
So karma's a odd thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of, business is full of a lot of all kinds of people. Fortunately, my belief is that, most of the people, particularly who lead businesses understand the difference between right and wrong. And they're generally trying to do right.
Have you found things within the business over the years where people were doing wrong and you were able to adjust that or got?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, people are trying to do the right thing by doing the wrong thing, you know, by, you know, trying to succeed at a business function, by taking shortcuts. And, you know, in this world, there just aren't a lot of real shortcuts. There are some that appear that way, but, you know, most of the time it's not a real thing. So,
and so the people that tell you that you did the wrong thing by laying off those 35 people, you should have found a way to keep them on. Take the money out of your own account, Gary.
To which I would say, you're right. You're right. It was preventable. We didn't prevent it. Could we have? What kind of knowledge? I don't know. We're human too. Mm-hmm. I've made lots of mistakes at business and with Deschutes Brewery, and I've told people, you know, that the only difference between when you make a mistake and I make a mistake is mine usually cost a lot more money. But I mean, I've made mistakes with people too. There's no question about it. But at the end of the day, I've got to live with what I tried to do. And, you know, I can still sleep at night.
It seems, are you telling me, are you pretty vulnerable with your staff?
We're pretty open.
Yeah.
I mean, we're, you know.
I mean, you've been open right now.
We're an ESOP because so we're open book anyway. We were open book before we did that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we tell people, we'll discuss anything with you except your coworker. We're not going to talk about them. You want to know about you, your job, your salary, our, you know, position in the industry, what our strategy is, what our tactics are, you know, what our KPIs are, all those kinds of things. Yeah, you bet. What do you want to talk about?
Do you talk about your own vulnerabilities, though? Like, I'm having a hard time with listening. Not saying you do, but just as like an example with your team.
Yeah, I'm like them.
Yeah,
I'm not perfect. I'm, you know, as I said before, I'm largely unqualified for most of the things that I'm tasked with doing.
Do you find
these
that
days.
Brings benefit when you're vulnerable with them?
Yeah. I mean, it's not. A burden. There isn't really a negative to that, as long as everybody still understands that the objective is the objective. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, so we failed at this part of it. Now, what are we going to make up to get to where we have to be? You know, it's funny. Accountability is a weird business concept that everybody likes to talk about, but nobody likes to do.
That's very true.
Yeah. You know, you're going to be accountable. Oh, really? What does that mean? So when things don't go well, what does your accountability mean? Well, it means that I'm going to do my best. No, you just said you're going to be accountable. Accountable, what, you're going to quit? I get to fire you? You're going to give me $100?
I think it should be that they're going to quit, right? If it's extreme enough.
Well, it depends on what accountability means, but maybe it's, okay, you got to give me 10 bucks. You know, I mean, whatever it is, what is accountability is a thing.
Yeah.
It's a measured thing. I think is probably closer to the definition. But if you say you're accountable, but you're not willing to do whatever it takes to fix things when they go wrong, to me, that's not being accountable.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think that we can ever expect that from people.
That's fine. Then use different language.
No, I wish we could, but I mean, just the fact that, you know, you being an owner and I being an owner, I would love that they would do whatever it takes, but they don't have the same economics. So what's really in it for them? They'll say they're accountable, but should I, like, doing my weekends, everything like that? Like, what's it really costing me? It's not my business that's going under. I could find another job. So to make them...
Depends on what they're accountable for.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we have them give them 10 bucks when they screw up, or 100, or 1,000,
yeah,
Well, but then all of a sudden you're evil for doing that.
Our sales guys get together, they have a swear jar. You know, I mean, there's some accountability in that.
Oh, yeah?
You know, swear, you got to put $2 in the jar.
I would lose a lot of money.
Then they, I don't know, they, yeah. So, you know, but you know, that's a form of accountability. It's not terminal,
mm-hmm.
but it, you know, it keeps everybody thinking about it. And it adds a little humor to the room and all that. But I just think that there's not enough real accountability. When I say I'm accountable, that means, you know, if things don't go the way I think, then I'm going to be on the hook for fixing them.
I agree with you. I just want to know how can we, as business owners, how can we put in something to enforce it?
Well, how do you establish the goals? I mean, you can't manage what you can't measure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, accountability is a thing. You got to define what that means ahead of time. So if we fall short of this goal that you're accountable for, how are we going to make up the difference? You can't just leave it. So what are we going to do? What's plan B, plan C, plan D, you know, whatever it takes, which is a weird concept. People don't get too much anymore.
No.
You know, what are we going to do to make up the difference? We can't afford to be short.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are the things. And that conversation yields a whole bunch of interesting thoughts in my experience.
So measure the results, number one. Like, have a scoreboard is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. KPIs,
key business objectives, mm-hmm. KPI, key performance indicators, and basically, like what we use is a dashboard that kind of shows us, you know, where we're at and what our goals are, mm-hmm. Whatever the thing is. So have something to be measurable, and then when it comes to accountability, if we could break that down a little more on how you do it. Do you have multiple people per KPI? Do you have one person per KPI?
It depends. It depends on the KPI. I mean, it may be a department, maybe a team, maybe an individual. If it's a department or a team, there's a leader, there's a manager of the department, there's a leader of the team, you know. Mm-hmm. So there is a form of hierarchy for who's gonna lead us into this thing and who's gonna lead us out of it.
And what are the ones you hold yourself accountable for?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to hold myself accountable for too many things anymore because I have very, very few operating responsibilities anymore. We have a CEO, we have a CFO, we have key senior leadership, mm-hmm. in every facet of the business now.
Okay.
So, you know, I found my Peter principle some time ago, my level of incompetence, and hired people to support those areas that I just simply didn't have the skill set or the motivation to handle on my own. So, you know,
was that hard for you to do in the beginning? Admit that you didn't have the skill set for as it grew.
You know, it in a weird way that wasn't the hard part. The harder part was, and maybe this is similar, but you know, I'm kind of a control freak, a bit of type A, and I like to have my hands in everything, and so I was, you know, my challenge was avoiding kind of seagull management, mm. you know, swoop and poop kind of stuff, you know, come in, shit all over everything, and then leave, and that's,
I haven't heard that before, you know.
Yeah, but you'll remember it now.
I know, yeah.
Because it's true. And, you know, I would come and I'd not attend a meeting for a few weeks and then drop into a meeting and I'd go, what the hell are we doing? You know, and make a mess of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't good, fair, or or anything else. So
how'd you learn that? How'd you learn that you were doing that?
I was told.
How'd you take that? The first time. Hey, Gary, you swoop and poop on all our meetings.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can think back and go, you know, I'm pretty open to criticism. I don't, you know, we have an open door policy. My door is always open. It's not a metaphor. You want to come in and talk, you want to come in, you got something to say to me, come and shut the door. Great. You got something honest, legitimate criticism about me, you bet. I'm all ears. I may have something to say back, and I don't want you to be cavalier in the way that you present that. I want it to be real, and I want it to be authenticated. But I'll work my ass off to correct whatever I'm doing wrong, mm-hmm. if I can. And I'm not prone to a lot of emotional outbursts or anything else. I mean, I can get excited, but people know that they can argue with me too. Mm-hmm. And they know that because sometimes in meetings, if nobody's arguing with me, I'll argue with myself. My point, it's true.
How does that start?
It's true. Well, I want, if it's an important decision, I want all sides of the issue to be examined and to be brought out. I don't want people, hiding behind something and say, well, I didn't really support that, or...
Hey, we need to go with this new Blackbeaut Porter thing. Yeah, but Gary, the traditionalists are really going to like the old one. We shouldn't go for it. Yeah, but no, look at Gary. This is kind of happening in the
absolutely.
World. Yeah, that's great.
No, and one of the areas where I think I can still contribute to the company is in creative areas, whether it's marketing, graphics, or whether it's beer formulation and flavor. Profile formulation and those kinds of things. So, and I like those things. So I like to be involved in them, and I want to sit around in the brainstorming sessions, and I want to be where the creative juices are flowing. And, and we can argue back and forth, have a very energized conversation. And I can tell you in virtually 100% of the times when we have that process, it results in a much, much better outcome.
I'm sure, because then probably other people will jump on one side of the Gary's and one will jump on the other side and you get them talking
It's not about being my friend, but if you want to argue against me, you better support your argument.
Yeah.
Because I have reasons for the way I believe the way I do. And I expect you to have reasons for believing the way you do.
I'm sure you find times that you back down too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh no.
I didn't think of it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize that. I didn't. Okay. We'll go with your idea, but if it doesn't go the way we think, what's going to happen? So, you've got to be open. Life is too complicated and too short.
I was actually just asked this question the other day. It was yesterday, and I was going to Forever Free Cryotherapy. It's a new cryotherapy place off of Chandler.
Where they freeze your head?
No, they freeze everything but your head, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, good. So I like to beat the other loving crap out of myself mountain biking, so I was like, I'll give that a shot.
Oh, I've seen the one you're in a ice bath or a freezer.
It's nitrogen, yeah. And all of a sudden, and it's cold, but it ended up helping. But the question is they asked me, they're like, hey, we've seen your show. And I was like, oh, cool. And they're just like, we just got this business going. And I was like, yeah, I know. And they asked me, they're like, what's your number one tip to keeping a successful business going? And I was just like, holy shit. So I just sat there for a little bit, and I'm not even sure I gave her an answer, but I'm going to just drop that on you because I didn't put it to your questions. But what would be your number one tip to a small business to keep it going?
Well, I said it earlier, do the right thing first.
Do the right thing first?
Yeah.
I like that.
It's like when you tell the truth, you never have to remember what you said.
Mm-hmm.
Take that burden off yourself. Do the right thing, and then figure out how to...
Did you have a time in your life where you weren't doing that?
Oh, I think we were all young once, and probably, I
did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I for sure did.
Yeah. Not necessarily in business, but in my life.
Yeah.
I've screwed up lots of times in all manner of, activity.
Yeah, you seem incredibly wise about a bunch of stuff, which leads to my next question. What's the number one book you like to gift to people?
You sent me that question, and I had to think about it, because I read when I travel. I don't sit in my living room and read much, mm-hmm. but I do like to read, and I wrote down two books, and one of them was, you know, a quasi business book, and that's Shoe Dog. It's one of the better.
I haven't read Shoe Dog yet.
Biopics that I've read, because it isn't so self-aggrandizing. I think, you know, Phil Knight had plenty of flaws. It's a great story about how Nike came to be, mm-hmm. and kind of blew up. There's a lot, you know, you read through that and you think, God, there's a lot of pieces missing in this story, but they probably had to manage it to so many words. But there's actually another one that I've been recommending to people, and I read it just off probably the New York Times bestseller list or something. But it's called The Immortal Irishman.
I haven't heard.
And it's a story. It's a historical novel, it's the story of Thomas Maher, who led the Irish brigades during the Civil War for Lincoln. And but his story starts far before that, in England, where he was an aristocratic kid who got caught up in the Irish potato famine advocating for the Irish, which got him exiled. And it's long story, great, you know, but really, really fascinating piece of history that, you know, growing up an American in American schools, I never heard anything about this. In studying the Civil War or that era of American history or anything else. But, you know, the Irish brigades were literally seriously cannon fodder in the Civil War. And really an interesting story about a very interesting person that you've never heard of.
Yeah, well, I'm going to now. The Immortal Irishman. I'm going to check that out for sure. When you were speaking about with businesses that are growing here in Central Oregon and yours, and all the good that we have from coming from it and everything like that, are you a little concerned that 10 Barrel doesn't need to pay a 0.57% on gross sales, and you do and I do for now on?
Honestly, I haven't really studied that tax measure yet. Our accountants and my CFO are providing that analysis, which I haven't received yet. If that's true, yeah, I would suggest that might not be quite so fair. I'd want to know why. You know, they're 100% owned by a big giant corporation.
But
why?
That's not based in Oregon.
Okay, so why do businesses get penalized simply because they're headquartered in Oregon?
I don't know, but maybe Deschutes should be headquartered in Boise. You could divert the Deschutes River.
There is a Deschutes River in Washington.
There you go, right?
And the Olympia Brewery was on the Deschutes River.
I didn't know there was a Deschutes River in Washington. Yeah, that's funny.
In Olympia.
If you could have like a billboard for the World Series that doesn't say drink Deschutes, it doesn't say that, it's about life or something you find philosophical, just something that you think make the world better, what would that billboard say?
Be something, I think, you know, something like in big letters, just say chill.
There you go.
Yeah. Exclamation point. Just people just chill.
Just chill out.
Yeah. I think, you know, something.
You've been seeing that a bit more lately.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, our public discourse is so disjointed and so polarized that we are not allowed to disagree anymore. I mean, it's really bad.
Unless it's online.
Oh,
then
well.
Let the arrows fly.
Well, yeah, because you know, people can say whatever they want with impunity.
I know. I sometimes think when we get hated on for different things, okay, I know you wouldn't say that to my face, and I wouldn't say that to yours. So why are you saying it behind a screen?
I live by some simple rules, and maybe it's that do the right thing first thing. But I don't think you should say anything online that you wouldn't say to their face.
I agree.
I think, a psychiatrist would say, somebody who's not in control of aspects of their own life, well, they can, sit and hurl invective at others, again, with impunity, and make themselves feel better about their miserable little lives. sorry, that was mean, wasn't it?
No, it's not. It's true. But, because think about it. When somebody ends up consuming, so what we're talking about is when people end up consuming content, and typically the hate happens in the comment section. So they consume the content and they're just like, you have no idea what you're talking about, you fat piece of crap, things of that nature. If you have to be a point in your life where you're consuming somebody else's content that they're trying to put out there in the world and help people with, and you're saying something negative about it, to me, I just feel bad for that person.
Well,
there has to be really bad going on in their life if that's the best thing they have with their time.
Right. Oh no, there's no question about that.
Yeah.
This is they're hurling that invective largely from their mother's basement. But yeah. Sorry, that was mean too, wasn't it?
But yeah. True. Mostly true.
So we've created this society that doesn't value people going out. Millennials aren't going out as much anymore. No. They're staying at home, inviting their friends over and binging on Game of Thrones and, ordering Papa John's pizza. Well, no, that's probably not. They're ordering,
vegan pizza.
Something from Uber Eats.
Yeah.
And, and they can get, wine and beer delivered by Amazon. I think that it's our the amount of human contact we get. I mean, when you used to communicate with somebody, what did you do? You picked up the phone and you called them.
Yeah.
We don't call anymore. We don't even call on our cell phones anymore. We text.
Sure.
And if you don't text back immediately, it's some kind of major social faux pas. Mm-hmm. I learned this from my kids.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, wait a minute. I figure if you want to talk to me, call me. If you're going to write me, then I'll write back when I have time. But apparently that's like a bad thing.
Well, at the same time, though, I mean, what you guys are doing right now to your branding is a big change. And what you're talking about as far as this new way of communicating is also a big change. And people are going to hate this branding, and a lot of people are going to love it. I think more people love it. I personally love it.
Honestly, the I love it, I hate it thing, I dig. I really do. And whether it's about the way the beer tastes or the way the graphics taste, I don't want cheap shots.
Yeah.
But you seriously have an issue with the way this stuff looks, or it doesn't feel like the old one did, and I love that. And this, I want to hear about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is our livelihood. I want to know if we did it right or if we didn't do it right.
Right. So, but it's big change, and that's needed to progress things, because if you don't change, in my opinion, in business, you're going to be stampeded, and that's just the end, because right. People change. And this is what you're criticizing is a change of communication.
We're trying to improve communicate. The whole objective is to improve the way we communicate with our consumers, and whether we communicate about who we are, what we're making, what the flavor profile is, or something else. We are trying to find ways to communicate with a consumer that doesn't communicate the way I did when I was in their place.
Okay, good, because that whole change is now happening. That's why the text thing is on the rise. I mean, you had Messenger on Facebook had 20 billion messages sent between people and businesses last month. 20 billion. So if that's the way things are, and think about it for yourself, like for a second, when you're flying on United or American, and there's a problem, what happens? You need to call, and you wait on the phone, you talk to a robot, And then the robot typically doesn't work. So you say representative, and then it says, but I still want to know. And you say representative, representative, and you start like, just calm down, bud. You don't have to get mad at the robot. It's not the robot's fault. And you get yourself. And then eventually, 20 minutes later, you're on the phone with somebody. Maybe I'm exaggerating. Sometimes I'm not. It's not an efficient process. Delta, on the other hand, you go on Facebook Messenger and you say, this is my flight number. This is me. You can see because it's connected to my Facebook and that's connected to my Delta account, blah, blah, blah. And it just got canceled and they're coming on and they're changing. So does Air France, and they're getting an explosion from that business because they're adapting with the change. So the thing is yes, we don't call each other as much as we used to, but there's something to be said on efficiencies on texting as opposed to phone calls. Because when I call my mom and I talk to her, it's never just, okay, let's meet 6 o'clock at 5 Fusion or Deschutes Brewery. It's that plus, oh, and then how's the day going? And then how's this and that? I'm like, mom, I love you, but we'll talk later tonight. And I'm trying to run a business.
Yeah. I got other things to do. I should have texted you.
Do you see what I'm saying, though? So there's big pros and cons.
No, I get it.
I get it.
But I think the human contact and interaction is what we miss. And I think we are lesser as a society as a result.
And perhaps.
Now, there are benefits to technology and modern ways of communication, whether it's Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or simply texting. But it is not everything. And of course, the classic is a family sitting down at a restaurant at dinner and the kids are, buried, noses buried in their phones and they're doing whatever they're doing. And
yeah, that's the worst.
And it's unfortunate, but it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And we seem to not be able to control the amount of technology even our children consume. Mm-hmm. And I just think people need to go down to the pub and have a beer and talk to each other.
I agree. So I love the technology to an extent. I'm somebody who freaks my friends out because when I go, majority of my friends live in Portland because I went to school at Oregon State and I was one of the only people that came to, I'm the only friend I know that came to Bend and started a business here, and the rest of them pretty much went to Portland, one in Salem. So that's where they're. And when I go and hang out with them, I'm like, all right, we're going out to the pub or whatever. I'm going to leave my phone here at your house. And they're like, wait, what? I'm like, yeah, because I'm here to hang out with you guys. And they're like, yeah, but what if there's a emergency? What if you need to call an Uber? I was like, well, I'll go with you guys. It's like, what if you lose us? I was like, then I'll call a taxi.
I'll talk to the bartender. He'll figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll figure it out. I'm a man. I'm a real man. I'll be able to figure this out. And then when I do that, and there's always an argument on it, even though I've done it like 5 times every time since I've been up there. So then we go to the pub, and there is, to your point, the unfortunate time when me and 6 or 7 of my friends will be sitting around like a bunch of couches at like a nice, mm-hmm. modern, swanky Portland bar, and there will be 3 to 4 occasions where they will all at once be on their phone texting, all 7 of them, and I'll be there going, so then I won $1 million, but I had to give it to one of you guys, so I had to figure out which one. And they're like, uh-huh. I'm like, okay. And that happens a few times, but I'm able to engage in the whole conversation. I'm able to see how people interact. I actually get different business ideas by watching how people are interacting in different things.
You know the worst thing about all that?
What's that?
The loss of common courtesy.
That's very true.
I mean, it's a simple concept. I wonder how these people date. Do they text each other dinner table?
No. You swipe right and you're a stud.
Oh. Damn it, I knew the answer to that question. I didn't think about it.
Instant gratification. Right. Yeah. I went on one swipe right, you're a stud dates, Tinder. I went on a few, but I went on one where, to your point, And again, my point is that there's benefits to this, and your point is there's this, and I'm actually agreeing with you, and there's a healthy balance. We got to find where that is. But the girl, she couldn't communicate with me to save her life. And I was keeping the conversation going, and I was, it was actually at Deschutes, and I was keeping the conversation going, and I was like, okay, yeah, yeah. And she's like, I was like, okay. And so then I went to the bathroom, and I'm taking a piss, and I get a text, and it's her, and she texts me, "Your smile is adorable." And I'm like, okay. So I walk back down your hallway and I'm sitting in front of the fireplace in Deschutes in the pub. And we're with her on one of those tall tables. And I'm like, thanks. I think your smile is adorable too. And she almost exploded. She didn't know what to do with that information. She didn't say anything. She made a bunch of weird noises. So that was the last date. But yeah,
that's,
to your
that's
point.
That's just so sad.
Yeah.
Because really I don't think there was a physical affliction. I think that was learned behavior. And I think that's what we're creating.
Yeah.
And these are the people that everybody worries about because they're going to be in charge of the world someday.
Well, they're not all like that. I mean, we're having a conversation. I'm a millennial. I think we're having a good conversation.
I have two daughters. Yeah. No. I have two daughters who are millennials, and they're
Mitch can
talk. They and their friends. I'm no longer afraid for the future of society until I hear stories like this, and it's like, oh,
well, it's not all of them. I've also gone on dates where a girl's able to talk. I'm just saying it does. It does happen.
It's so comforting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was actually one last story on this because it's so great. Was another time I was in Portland. I did this again, and we were in an Uber and we're going to go to some swanky Portland bar again, and we're in the Uber. My friend goes, "Wait, stop. I left my wallet." And so the Uber turns around, goes back in the driveway. And before my friend runs in, I'm like, "Hey, Mike, take my phone with you." And he's just like, "No, I can't do it." I was like, "Yeah, leave it on the counter." He's just like, I can't do that. I'm like, "Wait, what are you talking about? You can't do it. Just please do it. I want to spend time with you guys. I don't need to have my phone on me." And he goes, I can't do that. No, don't. You need your phone." And it's the same conversation. It's, "I don't need my phone. I'll be okay." And then the guy sitting shotgun, another good friend of mine, just turns back and goes, "Bud, no, you need your phone." I was like, "Britt, I don't need my phone." And so Mike was like, "Okay, fine." So he goes in, he comes back in, he sits down next to me. And I'm like, and we start driving away. And he goes, "I couldn't do it." He couldn't leave my phone there.
You know, there's a PhD in behavioral psychology somewhere in that story.
I think there's a few. You know,
and I think there's a dissertation of 300-400 pages in that.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, this is again sad, real, and this is, you know, as businesses. These are the people we're trying to communicate with and trying to understand how they make decisions, what are the values on which they make those decisions, and how to engage them in a way that can add value to them and profit to you.
Well, honestly, I feel that you shouldn't fight what's happening because unfortunately, I don't think it's a battle you could win.
Well, and
but it's a battle you could capitalize on. You could have a messenger bot for Deschutes where people can end up figuring out what's the best beer for them by going through and talking to something that's not even human, but they're used to it. So millennials are just like, "Oh, according to Deschutes bot, I really need to try Botanic Ale because I like gin and tonics." Hmm. It's kind of fascinating, but if you were to fight it, unfortunately, with Generation Y, which is worse than millennials when it comes to what we're talking about, the negatives, positives a lot better in other things. But as far as the negatives, yes, they're even more so on their phones. Actually, how it goes for them is that you start by being a Snapchat friend. Mm-hmm. And then if that ends up going well, you then graduate to text messaging and you get their number. So that's how that works. Fascinating with that. Okay. if you could take your mind, Gary, right now, and drop it into your 18-year-old body, what would you do?
God. Well, I'd probably, well, I'd be in a lot less trouble. I think I'd probably listen more, talk less, try to be more aware. You think that, it really is true that youth is wasted on the young, because by the time you, and you're still learning this, but by the time you acquire the wisdom that, and the economic wherewithal that you can actually do some things, now physically things don't work the way they used to and all this kind of stuff. So I think that's partly why millennials are to a certain extent doing, kind of life steps in reverse. I mean, my daughter, who's 29, last year she took a year and traveled around the world with a group of 70 other people.
Wow.
Who could all work remotely, professionals of various professions.
Really?
There's a company called Remote Year that puts together these groups.
Yeah.
And you move every month to a new city around the world. And and work remotely. She works for a software company in Denver. And what an incredible group of people. And an incredible experience, but they're not interested in buying a home, getting married, starting a family, doing things in an order that my generation did. When I was that age, I was too worried about paying rent and, all the things that I had to do to maintain my life. They're not interested in that. They don't have as many possessions, and the possessions they do have, they can put out on the curb, but somebody will pick it up when they're ready to go. And
it's kind of a beautiful thought to have when you don't have materialistic things to be an anchor to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was all a big scam when she first brought it to me. I thought, mm-hmm. Well, that's the cheapest excuse for a white slave racket I've heard in a long time. But it's a real thing. It's a great company. The groups of people they put together, I mean, this was as diverse a group as you can imagine. Mostly American, but not entirely. They had, a lot of people that worked in tech, but not entirely. Mm-hmm. There was a woman who designed fragrances for Nordstrom's. There was a man who was a professional photographer. There were people, the boyfriend that she came back with owns a landscape construction company in New Jersey.
What?
People figure out ways to do this.
He owns a landscape construction company in New Jersey?
Yeah. He took the summer off of around the world and flew back to New Jersey for 3 or 4 months and then went back and rejoined the group.
Oh, good for him. That's pretty cool. Huh. So, basically, what would you do different then? You listen more?
Yeah, I think I was pretty cocky as a young kid, and I think I was.
So am I still, I guess. Yeah, I'm working on it.
But at 18, you got to think, what was I doing at 18? Well, I was getting in trouble. I was spinning my wheels. I was going to junior college when I shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. I was not in a good place. But, coming out of it, I grew up in California, but right after that, when I was 19, I left California, moved away to finish college, and that was to a place where I didn't know anybody, nobody knew me. It was the best thing I ever did.
I feel like if we were to drop your brain and the 18-year-old you, we would be drinking Deschutes today out of frickin' water fountains.
Yeah, maybe.
it would just be everywhere. Like, you're drinking, don't drink water. It comes from the toilet. You drink Deschutes.
Yeah. This is just enhanced water.
Exactly.
So, no, I think, You know, if you had the wisdom you had today when you were 18, yeah, God knows what you could accomplish. I mean, what you'd want to accomplish. I think there's a lot to be said for that. But, you know, I guess that's why it takes a long time to acquire any measure of knowledge and wisdom.
And life's about the journey too, because if you just had the wisdom at your age and you couldn't look back, you would have less appreciation for it if that's the way you were the whole time.
Yeah, but I'm relatively certain I might not make the same mistakes, but I'd be making mistakes.
Of course you would. You're gonna make a mistake again this week, and I'm gonna make probably 18. And just keep on moving and learning from it.
Yeah.
Well, Gary, hey, I appreciate you being on the show, man. It's been
I appreciate
fun.
It as well. It's been a lot of fun. It's easy to drink beer and talk.
Yeah, agreed. And great new beers. Thanks, man.
Hey, thanks. Cheers.